my place in tech changes every day. But I don't fear the future, because I'm with the leader, Pluralsight. Their online learning platform has the hands-on, expert-led courses I need to master new tech skills and create bigger impacts, so I can learn quickly and stay ahead. With Pluralsight, I don't fear what's next. I embrace it. Tap in at Pluralsight.com and see for yourself.
Lost in the fog of a cosmic storm, floating on whims of the wavelengths is the norm. Dancing through the stars, chasing spectrums of light. Riding the waves that are just out of sight.
Welcome back to Whimsical Wavelengths. I'm your host, Dr. Jeffrey Zer. Quick update, though. Like many podcasts, I'll be taking a summer break. I'm starting to fall behind and cutting it too close to meet my deadline, so summer will allow me to get in front of it all again, I hope. I can work on a bunch of different stories and gear up for a restart in mid-September. Whimsical Wavelengths will see a season 2. Haven't been canceled yet, but for now, I have at least 2 episodes that will take us to the end of season 1. The rest of the summer will be encore episodes to fill the bi-weekly space. Today, we're going to start to cover a real scientific disaster story. No, it's not the Hollywood variety, although maybe it should be. And maybe it will be. I mean, we have the movie Oppenheimer. To tell the whole story here requires multiple main characters. Perhaps a TV series, then? I've known I wanted to tell this story for some time, but have struggled on the best way. But here we go. And it starts at the gas pump. And a question: ever wonder why all the pumps say unleaded gas? Or perhaps ask the question, why would they need to? This is a story about scientific discovery, advocacy, environmentalism, and corporate greed. It has direct ties to the Manhattan Project and the Age of the Earth, between the 2 episodes anyway. So buckle up, because here we go. I think I'm going to start with some history of lead before launching the story, at least the beginning of the human story. I bet anyone listening to this podcast already knows lead is not good for you, our health in general. A notable scandal in the last 15 years is the Flint, Michigan water crisis, where pipes containing lead brought water to the homes of people. That story isn't finished yet, and it is more complicated than lead, even though it is faded from the headlines. I'll drop some links into the show notes if anyone wants to see where that is going and still moving forward. Lead, or PB on the periodic table, is one of the earliest metals utilized by ancient people due to its malleability and low melting point of only 327.5 degrees Celsius. Or, for those people just down south of me, 621.5 degrees Fahrenheit. The natural occurrence mined for this element, including today, is lead sulfide, or galena. It's relatively easy to find and doesn't require complex processes for extraction. Because it is so easy to manipulate, it can be extracted or smelted at low temperatures. The metal has a rich and complex history stretching all the way back to at least 6,500 years before Christ. That first occurrence was a lead bead found in the region of modern-day Turkey. Lead became more common in the empires or kingdoms of Mesopotamia and Egypt, being found in amulets, weights, and figurines. Egyptian tombs were found to contain lead-based cosmetics, black eyeliner, for example. Evidence of lead's toxicity has been observed since the antiquity, albeit often misunderstood, ignored, or suppressed due to lead's widespread utility. Humans have a history of ignoring issues due to how useful something is. Climate change. Oh, sorry. Just a little bit of a cough there. There have been some successes, though, and we'll circle back to those eventually. Ancient Greek culture used lead for plumbing, roofing, and sling bullets. Our first written accounts of lead potentially being terrible for one's health are also from the Greek or Macedonian Empire. Rome. When in Rome, all roads lead to Rome. all men think about Rome? I guess I'm guilty. Okay, deviation. What a bizarre thing. What began as a TikTok thing has some truth to it? Question mark. Men are much more likely than women to report regularly thinking about the Roman Empire. The story or viral sensation suggests that men think about ancient Rome way more often than women. Okay, let's go beyond just the TikTok and those who are self-selecting respondents in it, and go to a YouGov poll that shows only 4% of American men say that they think about the Roman Empire every day. Now, it's still true that that number is significantly higher than the 1% of women who say the same. To put it a different way, American women are 22 percentage points more likely to say they never think about the Roman Empire than men. So there is some truth to the TikTok lunacy. And you know what? If it wasn't for reading Percy Jackson to my two monsters, I mean kids, actually, I have no idea how often I think about Roman Empire. Is thinking about historical thought really thinking about the empire itself? How often do I rewatch The Life of Brian? All right, but apart from sanitation, medicine, education, wine, public order, irrigation, roads, the fresh water system, and public health, what has Rome ever done for us? Okay, back on topic. The Roman Empire used a lot of lead. Lead pipes for transporting water, lining public baths and construction, tableware, cookware, cosmetics, paints, and medicinal applications? Okay, well, perhaps the worst was using lead acetate, a sweet-tasting compound, as a sweetener, leading to chronic exposure, particularly an issue for the aristocratic classes. Through wine. You see, Romans often boiled grapes in lead cauldrons or pots to concentrate it. Lead, easy to work with, to create large pots, conducts heat evenly, and importantly, leads to lead acetate being formed because you have the lead cauldron, the heat, and the tantric acid naturally found in grapes, and lo and behold, you get lead acetate. PbC4H6O2. The lead acetate gave the wine a sweeter flavor. However, it could have as much as 20 milligrams of lead per liter in Roman wine. Okay, numbers. I don't expect you to know that 20 milligrams is crazy. Let's put that in perspective. Although there is no acceptable level of lead, it is found in trace amounts everywhere. In Canada, drinking water must have at less than 0.005 milligrams per liter, meaning Roman wine could have 4,000 times more lead than our modern standards. The use of lead in winemaking correlates with a decrease in fertility and an increase in psychosis among the Roman aristocrats. All of this data leading some to speculate that lead poisoning played a part in the fall of Rome. Yeah. More on this and lead's effect in society later in the sibling episode. Bum bum bum. Foreshadowing. After the Roman Empire collapsed, lead was in less demand, but it was still widely used. Demand picked up again in the 15th century due to the invention of the printing press. More specifically, an alloy of lead, antimony, and tin. Over all this time, from Greeks to the end of the Renaissance, there were observations, data, and writing that lead was dangerous. An example from 1656, the English physician Samuel Stockhausen published On the Poisonous Diseases of Miners. He identified lead fumes and dust as toxic, and associated it with lung disease and nervous system damage. He's often considered a pioneer in the occupational medicine. This type of data and observations led to some restrictions to protect workers in glazing and ceramics. But in reality, it took till the 20th century. Lead's usefulness just mostly outweighed the concerns, and its use remained extremely widespread. Sad. Seems we fall into this trap way too often. One of the first laws that tried to rectify some of the ills that lead caused is from 1864. The United Kingdom Factory Act, one of the earliest laws to limit lead exposure for women and children in certain workplaces, to pull a sentence from the act. Every factory to which this act applies shall be kept in a cleanly state and must be ventilated in such a manner as to render harmless so far is practical. Any gases, dust, or other impurities generated in the process or manufacture that may be injurious to health. I guess it was a step. Enforcement wasn't exactly strict, so you could ask the question, was this law useful? Perhaps the real first push to deal with the effects on workers started in 1919 by the International Labor Organization. Today, the organization is part of the United Nations. Back then, it was part of the League of Nations. Its mandate was to advance social and economic...
This podcast is sponsored by IQBar.
I've got good news and bad news. Here's the bad news. Most protein bars are packed with sugar and unpronounceable ingredients. The good news? There's a better option. I'm Will, and I created IQBar Plant Protein Bars to empower doers like you with clean, delicious, low-sugar brain and body fuel. IQBars are packed with 12 grams of protein, brain nutrients like magnesium and lion's mane, and zero weird stuff. And right now, you can get 20% off all IQBar products, plus free shipping. Try our delicious IQ Bar sampler pack with 7 plant protein bars, 4 hydration mixes, and 4 enhanced coffee sticks. Clean ingredients, amazing taste, and you'll love how you feel. Refuel smarter, hydrate harder, caffeinate larger with IQ Bar.
Go to eatiqbar.com and enter code BAR20 to get 20% off all IQ Bar products, plus free shipping. Again, go to eatiqbar.com and enter code BAR20.
Economic justice by setting international labor standards. One of the UN's oldest specialized agencies and founded on the utopian ideas of the founding members. Social justice and the right to decent work. A complete aside, see, people were talking about social justice way back at the turn of the 1900s. So recommendation number 4 in 1919 under the International Labor Organization was an attempt to ban white lead from paint. White lead is a complex salt containing both carbonate and hydroxide ions used as a pigment to make paint a nice, bright white. An outright ban was pushed back on by industry, and a compromise was made, eventually. Convention number 13, adopted in 1921, prohibited the use of white lead in the internal painting of buildings for those countries that signed on. 50 in total, so quite a lot, but notably many of the behemoths of industry did not sign on to it. This is a good spot to pause the history of lead and regulation, because this is the time frame where the story really picks up in earnest. Yeah, you know what? My prologue is out of the way, and it's time to introduce the characters of the main story. The first is the invention of the automobile. In short, the first to be produced came out in 1888 in Germany. By 1903, 62,000 were being produced. The growing popularity of the automobile led to improvements, and not just the car itself. The petroleum industry, between this and coal, the stage was set for some of the issues we're facing today. Cars and the need for standardized fuel brought about technology to produce gasoline, replacing kerosene and coal oil. We'll come back to that in a second. But with the increase in heat and burning of these new fuels, the need for heat-tolerant mineral oil lubricants also became larger. So humans developed new products, replacing vegetable oil and animal oil. New technology disrupts the marketplace, and a cascade of changes follows. Sounds familiar, I bet. Not unlike the internet or the smartphone. A short skip to after World War I, the era of the auto, or the automobile, from 1919 to the Wall Street crash at the end of 1929, is called the vintage era. The need for speed saw the need for an anti-knocking agent for the internal combustion engine to run better. Before jumping into that, maybe it's time for a quick combustion engine summary. First, combustion means, well, the act of burning. To be more jargony, it's an exothermic redox chemical reaction between fuel and an oxidant. With respect to the combustion engine, it's gasoline and atmospheric oxygen, respectively. The internal combustion engine consists of at least one cylinder and a moving piston. Gasoline and air mix in the cylinder and combust, causing pressure upwards on the piston, which in turn rotates what is called the crankshaft. This movement or work is transferred through a system of gears and ultimately turns the vehicle's wheels and makes it go. The cycle includes four distinct and carefully calibrated processes in a modern-day engine: intake, compression, combustion, and power stroke and exhaust. Change the fuel properties and the engine can have it destroy itself through mistimed detonations of the fuel and combustion. Or if you fill up a gasoline vehicle, for instance, with diesel, it just won't run because diesel has a higher flash point. And so it's not going to be able to run at all. In other words, fuel is vitally important to really get the most out of an engine. And to do that, it all needs to be under just the right amount of pressure for the particular fuel, to get that mixture right of fuel and air. And that perfect ratio is to time and get the right force to time the ignition. If that mixture is off or the timing is off, if the spark happens too late or too early, it will cause the engine to knock. The sound created by the off-time detonation or combustion of fuel sounds the same as if metal parts have been tapped with a hammer, and hence the name. To remove knocking, there's a number of things you can try. Changing the ignition timing, the use of fuel with a higher octane rating, which increases the combustion temperature of the fuel and reduces the proclivity to detonate. Enriching the air-fuel ratio, which alters the chemical reactions during combustion. This reduces the combustion temperature. Reducing peak cylinder pressure, or decreasing the manifold pressure by reducing the throttle opening or boost pressure, and reducing the load in the engine. Based upon that list and the fact that to go faster requires more force, requiring higher cylinder pressures to turn the crankshaft, all this means that if you really wanted to get rid of engine knocking back in the day to increase fuel efficiency and power of the combustion engine, requires a fuel with higher octane rating. So in the early 20s, to get engines to be more efficient, faster, required more pressure. But that would cause knocking and therefore damage to the engine components. If only there was something that could be added to gasoline to increase its octane to act as an anti-knocking agent. Well, this is where we start to step off solely from history and begin the descent into the gloom of a real tale of corporate greed and conspiracy. I'm only going to kind of touch and dance around the edges of the corporate greed and conspiracy. But we're getting to the reason that gasoline pumps now say unleaded. I'm at a loss if I should really introduce a real person finally, or just stick to the non-people history and the scientific principles. There are so many different ways to tell this story. Well, let's start with Thomas Midgley Jr., who is kind of the main character in this episode. He was working for General Motors, GM, in 1921. In fact, he will be at the center of a movie called Midge, which I think is in pre-production right now. I have no idea how the movie will cover the man and his inventions, and I'm curious how this episode will measure up. Throughout it all, we are led to believe his inventions were to help mankind. However, his two greatest inventions threatened life on Earth, and no, that is not a hyperbole. And in the end, he was actually killed by his last invention. Yeah, he's a central character in the story. So, who was this guy? Thomas Midgley was born on May 18th, 1889. By coincidence, I was actually writing this on his birthday. Of course, this is now coming out much late. Sometimes it just takes forever to get an idea to paper all the way through and get it out to you guys. It takes me a lot of time. But I guess let's circle and zoom out and do some broad information and then dive into the details. Well, his parents were inventors themselves. Dad did some neat things with tires, and his mom invented the inserted tooth saw. They're not the subjects here, but to have an idea where Thomas Midgley came from, it kind of helps. He was also a jock in his younger years, playing baseball. And when the curveball or spitball was all the craze, he figured out how to use tree sap to make the ball slippier. And that slipperiness made for a better curve, a technique the pros would eventually use. He was also privileged enough to have the opportunity to go to academy to prepare for college. He was definitely intelligent, perhaps because he didn't grow up in a lead-laden world. That'll be covered more in the next episode, but his exposure at this time would have been minimal, as long as he wasn't exposed to fresh lead paint or eating from painted surfaces. This wouldn't always hold true, though, especially later in his life. It was at this academy that he went to that Thomas Midgley Jr. would interact with the subject of chemistry. His chemistry teacher, H.M. Robert, described and written about by Thomas Midgley in his own words. By golly, he advanced the thought that the regular arrangement of atoms was evidence of the existence of a deity. I disagree, and we argued. I contend that it is simply indicated by the atoms we were made up of, still smaller particles. Well, the arguments and the banter with his chemistry professor about science and a deity didn't send him on to study chemistry. Maybe the world would have been safer if he had. He went on to study mechanical engineering at Cornell University. Going back to when he joined up with GM, he was put in part of a research group to figure out how to remove knock from engines. And he began by building a device to obtain a graphical representation of the pressure within the cylinder. He later added something that could give you an optical indication so that
This podcast is sponsored by IQ Bar. I've got good news and bad news. Here's the bad news. Most protein bars are packed with sugar and unpronounceable ingredients. The good news? There's a better option. I'm Will, and I created IQ Bar plant protein bars to empower doers like you with clean, delicious, low-sugar brain and body fuel. IQ bars are packed with 12 grams of protein, brain nutrients like magnesium and lion's mane, and zero weird stuff. And right now, you can get 20% off all IQ Bar products, plus free shipping. Try our delicious IQ Bar sampler pack with 7 plant protein bars, 4 hydration mixes, and 4 enhanced coffee sticks. Clean ingredients, amazing taste, and you'll love how you feel. Refuel smarter, hydrate harder, caffeinate larger with IQ Bar.
Go to eatiqbar.com and enter code BAR20 to get 20% off all IQ Bar products, plus free shipping. Again, go to eatiqbar.com and enter code BAR20.
Combustion could be viewed. Eventually, after refinements and tinkering and all the stuff that happens throughout this engineering process, it became a sophisticated instrument known as the bounce pin indicator. Much better than the first investigators who were trying to solve this problem, who relied upon their ears to compare the intensity of different pings caused by knock. Now he had an instrument that he could measure the knock quantitatively. From those quantitative observations, it seemed knocking had more to do with the fuel than the engine. Coming back to that whole octane issue that we mentioned earlier, Midgley, who was a scientist at heart, followed the trail and began to investigate chemistry of fuels instead of the mechanical engineering approach. His first attempt into this field of chemistry was really just guess and check, trying a bunch of different fuels with different additives and using the instrumentation he built to measure the knock. It didn't really go well. A different approach was eventually taken, one that harkens back to his time in the chemistry classroom. The periodic table. And the periodic table is always useful, unlike me, who's only funny periodically. Midgley used property trends across the periodic table to predict what might work and solve his problem. Let me put it this way in a very clear explanation that everyone can understand. The column of alkali minerals, like lithium, we know how they react with water. The reaction gets more energetic as the increase in size and protons. So as you go from lithium to sodium, etc., down the line, they become much more energetic when they react. They also all each behave similarly. They can be fairly easily charged, ionized, and mobile, which is useful in, say, a battery. And just think, sodium batteries are probably on the way. Any rate, Before we get too sidetracked, he used the periodic table to provide direction and guidance to test fuel additives, and that process brought about tetraethyl lead, or TEL. It's produced by reacting chloroethene with sodium lead alloy. Lead and sodium are abundant and cheap, and the process could be patented. Yeah, it's early 1920s. We knew all about lead's health concerns. But this solved an anti-knock problem in a way that they could make money. Yeah, money. There was other anti-knock compounds like alcohol, but that wasn't patented and had other problems. Okay, yes, now that we brought up alcohol, it's time for another deviation. You know, oil was not always preordained to take over the world. Sticking with the same rough timeline, we need to talk about alcohol. We tend to see the world today as, obviously, oil was the reason cars caught on. It's actually a lot more complicated than that. When oil was first extracted, it was done with comparatively light crude. They didn't need to do much to get the products they could use, primarily kerosene. The heavier parts of what was extracted from the crude was waste. They began to basically throw it out or burn it in open pits. The fledgling oil industry also underwent some good old capitalistic merging into monopoly pretty quick under the banner of Standard Oil in North America. A corporation like that has money, has the ability for research, and most importantly, has the ability to find new markets. And of course, with all of that comes power. For most of the world, from the invention of the automobile until about the 1930s, the most available fuel was actually alcohol. Many vehicles and motors at the time could run on both. But alcohol is not as energy dense. At the same time, it could compete with gas if the engine was designed for it. Because alcohol could be run with higher cylinder pressures. Yeah, you can have less knock and get better fuel efficiency. You could actually compete with gas because you could go at this higher pressure. And perhaps an oil-alcohol blend was the best of both worlds. Surprise. The US, though, was going through some stuff with respect to alcohol. Prohibition and previous taxes made oil the cheaper fuel. For most of the rest of the world, alcohol was actually the cheaper fuel, hence why it was more available. Today, oil is obviously more available for this kind of fuel. It's hard to imagine being able to produce enough alcohol to run all the engines of today. Maybe if oil was passed up, we'd have to switch to electrical vehicles earlier, and maybe we'd not have the same climate issues. A whole lot of ifs. But let's just run some back-of-the-envelope numbers here, with lots of caveats. Worldwide, we use about 27 million barrels of gasoline per year for cars, amounting to 4.29 billion liters. Assuming we need to use one-third more alcohol to meet the same energy needs, results in little over 5.5 billion liters. Working with the best-case scenario, to grow enough material to get that amount of alcohol requires 9,000 to 14,000 square kilometers. That's about approximately 1% of the current usable arable land, which in and of itself sounds crazy, meaning it might have been possible to replace all that motor fuel. Realistically, replacing all the oil with alcohol, you'd need more than four times the land area to produce enough sugar through corn and sugar grass and beets to create enough alcohol, bringing the total to about 4% of the farmland used today. The difference is huge and crazy given where we are today, but the numbers don't actually seem too nuts. Perhaps it could have been done. Perhaps oil wasn't foreordained. The energy density of oil products is important, though, and you can't just set that aside, especially when we start talking about airplanes and the like. Regardless of this discussion, oil won. And tetyl ethyl lead was a patented process allowing for better fuel economy and more powerful engines running gasoline. But lead, burning of fuel and putting lead into the air out the tailpipe. Yikes. As stated above, the health effects of lead were fairly well known by this point. it didn't take long for the red flags to be raised. For instance, there was a situation in New Jersey in October 1924 where 5 workers died producing tetylethyl lead and 35 others were showing signs, serious signs of neurological symptoms because of lead poisoning. That was like 75% of the workforce at this particular plant. There was also the instance when Thomas Midgley, the man himself, was facing a skeptical reporters at a press conference in the same month of 1924. Thomas Midgley dramatically produced a container of tetylethyl lead with the additive in question and washed his hands with it.
"Now I'm not taking any chance whatsoever," Midgley declared, "nor would I, doing that every day."
He was perhaps being a little disingenuous. To be fair, we don't know what he believed at the time or what he sounded like, but he had recently spent several months in Florida recuperating from lead poisoning. Yeah, crazy. I thought when I began fleshing out this episode, it would be done from like a one-dimensional story situation. Thomas Midgley was a bad scientist or something like that, a villain, an evildoer. Instead, if you dive into the early literature, he was celebrated, and not just by those that made money. He was able to solve scientific problems that led a team through discovery. He solved a tricky problem and was able to make a lot of money doing it. Tetraethyl lead wasn't his only addition to corporate science. Before getting to the corporate greed and the cover-ups, let's linger on Mr. Midgley. Importantly, when he was given awards, and he was given many awards, he accepted them with praise and sharing the results with his team and others. He really did solve scientific problems. He also seemed caught between wanting to be seen as a proper scientist, and maybe we should pause for a second. Even today, corporate science is seen almost like less so in many circles. And me personally, that's not really the case. There is some caveats to this because they have different, reasons for doing it and reasons to potentially hide it if it doesn't show what they want it to show. But fundamentally, science in the corporate world is still science. He did add to science outside of corporate America too, all about rubber. And he was also the most fond of that work, as it was seen as real science in his eyes, or somehow better or less tainted by the money of corporate America. All in all, in my view, I think it's more fair to see him, not as a villain, but as an employee. A person tasked to find a solution, and he did. And in all likelihood, if he didn't come up with this stuff, someone else would have eventually. And also, as you can tell, leaded gasoline was bad, but he also solved a very important problem by replacing noxious and flammable gases used in refrigeration and air conditioning. I think it's a little easy today with refrigerators in everyone's home across the West. It's really easy to understate just how big of a problem this was. A failing fridge back in the day in the turn of the century could cause you to die in your home. They used chemicals like ammonia and sulfur dioxide. This is not an exaggeration. Some of the chemicals used could also explode. The first at-home, self-contained fridge was produced in 1923. Well, shortly later, he found the first CFC, or chlorofluorine carbons, that were an ideal substitute and harmless to humans. Woohoo! Great. But they also destroys the ozone. Once they got into the atmosphere, data pointing out to them being a problem, built and built and built, and eventually in 1987, the Montreal Protocol was signed to phase out CFCs. It was a rare win, where people banned something, despite its usefulness. Perhaps a story in its own right for another time. Now, onto the final act of this episode. The corporate money. The corporate players involved here are, as already stated, General Motors, GM, Standard Oil, DuPont, and the Dow Chemical Company. Okay, let's just go over the last two a little bit as like their greatest hits. The Dow Chemical Company became the last producing company to produce napalm for Vietnam. They also produced Agent Orange. They had a merger with Union Carbide, another chemical company, but refused to deal with the history that Carbine had because they were the cause of the Bhopal disaster that caused over 500,000 injuries. And I'm just barely scratching the surface here. Dow has some history. DuPont isn't exactly your angel either. They provided Nazi Germany with patents, technology, and material resources that proved crucial to the German war effort, only to have it all confiscated by the Nazis in 1943. Yeah, they confiscated 2 years after the US entered the war. That's some corporate leadership there, yep. DuPont's own experts downplayed the dangers of chlorofluorocarbons, CFCs, that Thomas Midgley was largely responsible for first founding. Yeah, the company had wide-reaching projects everywhere. And company officials warned that curtailing the production of CFCs would result in the loss of several hundred thousand jobs. So they were trying really hard to delay that, because they wanted to see more money. In 2004, the Environmental Protection Agency of the United States of America charged that for two decades, DuPont failed to report the signs of health and environmental problems linked to a chemical used in making Teflon. Both these companies have a large history of messing up the environment and messing up people. Okay, let's leave that there for a moment. So GM and Dow began working together through some new companies to commercialize the process of making anti-knock additives through lead. In 1922, GM contracted with DuPont to manufacture it. DuPont owned 38% of GM stock, and two different DuPont brothers at the time were presidents of the two companies. From the initial contact, one pointed out the potentially large and profitable market for tetraethyl lead, but also warning of its known toxicity. So yeah, even the CEOs or the owners of those companies knew the problems existed, well before it became ubiquitous everywhere. GM wanted to produce this stuff fast, not safe. They wanted to get tetraethyl lead containing gasoline to market, and they started in 1923, before there was proper ventilation and procedures to keep workers safe. A DuPont worker recalled that the tetraethyl lead at these beginnings were handled in open buckets, and the operators dipped their fingers into it in order to test its look, its clarity, what was the fluid like. By the end of the first month of operation, one worker had died from poisoning, and others had less severe cases. Now we enter the Standard Oil Company. The Standard Oil had figured out a better way to manufacture tetraethyl lead. GM, though, had all the basic patents for the application as an anti-knock agent. The corporate villains of this story did what you would expect when they all wanted money. They joined forces, forming the Ethyl Gasoline Corporation in 1924. Remember just a few moments ago, I mentioned Thomas Midgley had lead poisoning just before that ill-fated media stunt? Well, it wasn't the only source of warning. There were also the correspondence between the fellow colleagues and other researchers stating how toxic that it was. Despite all of this, it seems Thomas Midgley was not all that concerned about the health issues. There were also some tests, we'll call them that, in 1924 where animals were exposed to leaded gasoline exhaust. But the results found the danger to the public of breathing lead in automobile exhaust was negligible. The previous example where workers died and many were hospitalized in the making of tetraethyl lead was not the only industrial accident. There was many others associated with the making of tetraethyl lead. It led to the Surgeon General getting a committee composed of authorities in areas of industrial hygiene and clinical medicine to conclude that gasoline was not a hazard to the public. There are, at present, no good grounds for prohibiting the use of ethyl gasoline with the composition specified as a motor fuel, provided that its distribution and use are controlled by proper regulation. However, yeah, there was so much new and increase in the number of automobiles, the committee recommendation was that the study should be continued under the supervision of the Surgeon General, just in case they missed something. Needless to say, that was never followed up on. The studies did not happen. So all in all, after a one-year hiatus, due to all of the industrial accidents and making of the product, leaded gasoline was back on the market, with more regulations to try to protect workers. So there we have it. There sets the stage for the use of leaded gasoline. It's wide usage in all kinds of engines the world over. Some conspiracy theories suggest that corporations actively suppressed evidence and bribed scientists and politicians to maintain the profitability of leaded gasoline. The idea that they prioritized profits over public health, knowingly exposing generations of people to a dangerous neurotoxin. Well, there's definitely some evidence to support some of this, as you can see in just the scientific literature that exists around lead, even the history of lead leading up to this point. I still get the feeling that people still were unable to understand, once it came out of the tailpipe, how much of it was actually getting into the environment, getting into people. And that's a great place to leave off. Because in the next side of these, both these episodes really could be treated as standalones. We start with the idea that lead's everywhere. And we're going to start talking about how one man, on a quest to figure out how old the Earth is, came about and basically stopped or provided the necessary data to take leaded gasoline out of the market. So this brings this episode to a close. Still a little concerned about what's going to happen in the next couple of weeks as I pare this down and get ready for a little bit of a summer hiatus to be able to balance the work, summer vacation trip with my monsters, I mean my kids, and getting ready for season two. I will be back for season two. I'll put in some of my favorite episodes from this season as kind of a stopgap before I restart in mid-September. That's right, it's how I'm going to celebrate my birthdays with the start of season two. All right, I'll see you in 2 weeks.
Lost in the fog of a cosmic storm, floating on whimsical wavelengths is the norm. Dancing through the stars, chasing spectrums of light. Riding the waves that are just out of sight. In a world so chaotic that misbehaves, melodies that echo show us six always. Colors intertwine, painting the sky. We're lost in the rhythm as the universe flies by. Oh, we're tuned in, feeling the beat of the unknown. Can you hear it? It's echoing through your bones. In this melodic maze, we let our minds soar. Science and knowledge, forever seeking more.
This podcast is sponsored by IQBar.
I've got good news and bad news. Here's the bad news. Most protein bars are packed with sugar and unpronounceable ingredients. The good news? There's a better option. I'm Will, and I created IQ Bar Plant Protein Bars to empower doers like you with clean, delicious, low-sugar brain and body fuel. IQ Bars are packed with 12 grams of protein, brain nutrients like magnesium and lion's mane, and zero weird stuff. And right now, you can get 20% off all IQ Bar products, plus free shipping. Try our delicious IQ Bar sampler pack with 7 plant protein bars, 4 hydration mixes, and 4 enhanced coffee sticks. Clean ingredients, amazing taste, and you'll love how you feel. Refuel smarter, hydrate harder, caffeinate larger with IQ Bar.
Go to eatiqbar.com and enter code BAR20 to get 20% off all IQ Bar products, plus free shipping. Again, go to eatiqbar.com and enter code BAR20.